All right, well, I just, for my Sunday morning series, we just finished up in Luke 16, so I want to take you back to Luke 16. I'm going to take this afternoon as an opportunity to talk about some techniques that our Lord uses when he is preaching. And I probably should have given this lesson earlier in the gospel, but maybe it'll still be of use to you in listening to sermons when we are hearing the teaching of the Lord, especially in the Gospels. In Luke 16, there is this very interesting parable. And you know in your Bibles, if your Bible has a title every so often dividing up the paragraphs, you know that those titles are not the Bible. Those are added by commentators and interpreters who are, I'm sure, doing their best to provide you an idea of what's coming up. And you've probably noticed that a lot of times in my sermon titles, my sermon titles don't reflect the title that may be at the front of the paragraph in your Bible. And this is one example where the title at the beginning of Luke chapter 16 is the parable of the unjust steward. And I think that's a horrible title. And if you want to just mark that out, if you have a pen, you have my permission, just go ahead and mark that out, because that's not at all the emphasis of the parable. The emphasis is, and this is how I labeled my sermon, it was a parable of the steward with foresight, something like that. Because that's the emphasis. That's where Jesus draws our attention. Okay, so the parable of this steward who showed this aspect of wisdom called foresight. Sometimes it's translated as shrewdness. But shrewdness in our minds probably usually has a negative connotation, although it shouldn't. It depends on what you're being shrewd about or how you're using that. Okay, so this is going to be an opportunity for us to think about techniques that the Lord uses when he's teaching. And we see these things especially in the proverbs and parables that the Lord gives. Now it'll sound strange for me to put it to you this way if I say that the teaching of the Lord reflects the teaching of the Old Testament. Obviously, it's his word. Whether we're in the old or new, it is his word that has been given by the Spirit, whether he gave it through the prophets or he's giving it through Luke. Obviously, the prophets of old spoke as they were moved by the Spirit of the Lord. So, of course, the word of the Lord is going to be consistent with the word that he gave through his prophets. It's going to be consistent with the word he gave through what we call the wisdom literature, which we typically think of as Job, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. So, obviously, the content is going to be consistent. But what I want to point out for you today is not only is the doctrine consistent when we're listening to the Lord, but there is a manner of speaking that the Lord adopts as well. And we see this here in Luke 16, and maybe after today you'll begin to pick up and you'll notice the Lord using certain techniques that you understand what I mean when I say he draws it from the techniques of the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, which is still his word. So he's drawing it from himself in the way that he has spoken through the prophets and the wise men of old. So when we are listening to Jesus speak a parable, and that word. Either in the Greek or the New Testament, is a generic word. So a parable could be a one-line thing, but we tend to call it a proverb if it's a one-line. A parable can be a proverb, a one-line proverb. It can be a whole story. It has a range of meaning. And the same thing with the Hebrew word in the Old Testament that tends to be translated as parable or proverb. It can be a short thing, it can be a long thing. And we find techniques in the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, techniques that are employed in the use of what we call the wisdom literature or a wise saying. Now, let me give you some examples from earlier in the Gospel of Luke. But before we do that, let's think about what we saw here in chapter 16. The story starts off with the steward. He's the manager. And right off the bat, he's getting fired. And he's fired because he's incompetent. And we think to ourselves, I see where this is going. And at the end of this, the Lord's going to tell us something like, now you don't be incompetent. See his incompetence, the Lord's going to say, now you don't get fired, or, you know, something like that. Hey, we got this figured out. Look at this. Look at this scoundrel here at the beginning of the story. We already don't like him. And then he gets fired, and he's supposed to go retrieve the books. But instead of going and retrieving the books and coming right back to the boss, he retrieves the books, and he goes to two different tenants, probably, on the land of the boss. And he then engages, or he adds to his incompetency, he adds lying, cheating, and stealing. And now we really don't like him. Now we're really for sure what direction the story is going. This has to be a lesson where the man is just completely—he's a completely awful, negative example for us not to follow. And we're going to be at the end of this and listening to Jesus make that kind of application. We think we know where it's going, and then we get to the end of it where he comes back to the boss, and the boss, Jesus says, praises him. And this causes a lot of consternation. Well, why would the boss praise the steward? And this has caused some consternation among some commentators. Well, how is it possible? Now, of course, Jesus then goes on to explain what it was that was being praised. And so this causes some turmoil in our minds because we're thinking, well, that was a big setup, and I don't like being surprised like that at the end. But that's a particular technique that the Lord is employing in Proverbs, and I'll show you that here in a minute. All right, so now let's go back earlier in the Gospel of Luke, and I want to show you some other proverbs that we've come across. I'm going to show you these just to show you that the Lord employs the use of proverbs and parables throughout. It's not just when the title at the front of the paragraph says a parable of. Let's go back to Luke. Let's go back to Luke chapter 4. Jesus is in the Nazareth synagogue. Sometimes Jesus will use a parable that on its surface seems to be fairly simple. It might be a little easier to understand. But if you dwell on it, it begins to work. It begins to do its work. And this is one of the designs of a proverb is, even on the ones that seem to be fairly simple, the intent is that you pitch your tent on it for a little while, and you camp out on it, and you meditate on it, and you think about it, and you let this proverb, you roll it over in your contemplations, and you roll it over in your mind, and it begins to unfold things that maybe you didn't see at the beginning. Okay, so here's an example in the Nazareth synagogue. Jesus is quoting from one or two places in Isaiah, and he says, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." And then, "So all bore witness to him and marveled at the gracious words which proceeded out of his mouth, and they said, 'Is this not Joseph's son?'" Now, I believe that we need to interpret verse 22 as a negative reaction to Jesus. This marveling or astonishment, yes, his words were gracious, but this marveling was not a marveling that was joined with thankfulness. Not that kind of marveling that you know of. That sense of wonder and amazement that goes along with gladness. You know what that is. But I don't believe that that's what's happening here. Because they then say, is this not Joseph's son? So they hear this man. The stories about him have come back to Nazareth. He's been in the region. Stories of his miracles and wonders and preaching have moved ahead of him back to his hometown. And they're gathered there. And this is their response now that they've heard a messianic claim. It's a clear, undeniable messianic claim. They would have understood Isaiah to be speaking of the Messiah doing this work, and now it's Joseph's son is the one making this claim. Joseph's son? This is not what they would have been expecting. They would have known the Messiah. They would have remembered the prophecies from Daniel and others. They would have known, they would have had this idea of kingship. The Messiah was going to be a king, a deliverer. And so they're saying, Joseph's son. Well, Jesus picks up on this, of course, right away. He reads what's going on. This is why in verse 23 he says to them, you will surely say this proverb to me, physician, heal yourself. Now we have, we could put it, how would I put it? There's the proverb about the cobbler whose own kids don't have their shoes fixed, right? The idea is, physician, take care of your own house. You've been out healing others, right? That's what the doctor does. He's at the office all day. And who might be the most neglected in terms of his medical skill? Might be those who are even his own house, right? Jesus has been away in the region. He's not been in Nazareth. And so he says to them, you are going to quote this little proverb to me, or really, to put it better, you're already in your heart saying this to me. You're already in your heart saying to me, physician, heal yourself. Whatever we have heard done in Capernaum, do also in your country. We've heard that you have performed signs and wonders and healings in other areas. It's our time. It's our turn. We want you to do that here. Physician, heal yourself. Cobbler, it's come back home and repair the shoes in your own house. Electrician, come back home and get the lights working in your house. Nazareth is your house. This is your hometown. Physician, heal yourself. Whatever we've heard you do in Capernaum, do here. So their marveling is not one with thankfulness or gladness. Their astonishment is with disappointment. And then with this proverb that's in their heart, Jesus, take care of your own. That's what the proverb means. Take care of your own. So that's pretty simple on the surface, isn't it? But you let that proverb roll around in your mind, it's providing Jesus is diagnosing what's going on in their hearts. Would anybody like to offer a suggestion as to what kind of a heart says that to Jesus? Take care of your own. What kind of a heart says that? Anybody? I think of the word selfish. I think self-centered. Take care of your own. There's some commentators that when they go to that, they go to verse 23, whatever we have heard done in Capernaum, some commentators take that as a statement of doubt. We've heard. The news is that you've done this and you've done that over there. Prove it. Some commentators think that there's an expression of suspicion in their hearts. So I think that this little proverb, Jesus, heal your own, take care of your own, there may be some suspicion and doubt swirling in their hearts, because after all, it's Joseph's son. Joseph's son. We know Joseph. And we know Jesus. He grew up. Some of them could have said, we've known him since he was small. Him? So doubt and suspicion, and selfishness. Look at what kind of heart says to Jesus, take care of us. Well, they've just heard him quote from Isaiah about healing the blind. And I think that what the conception in their mind is that they're looking at Jesus as meeting just material, physical needs. They have in their hearts, they're not low before the Lord, ready to ask him for his mercy. Their hearts are very high and proud before him, demanding that he meet some material or physical need to give them some wonder. These things that they've heard that he's doing in other places. So, take care of your own. It's a simple proverb. Physician, heal yourself. But it's providing a deeper diagnosis if you let it work. And then, of course, the context itself tells us that there's a deep diagnosis going on of suspicion and doubt and selfishness and having this conception of the work of the Messiah in material physical terms. Look at the next proverb there in chapter 4. Then he said, assuredly, I say to you, and here's another proverb. No prophet is accepted into his own country. A simple one-line proverb. No prophet is accepted in his own country. Pretty simple on its surface, isn't it? That a prophet of God, or God's prophets were not received by the children of Israel. All right, we have this over and over again in the history laid out for us in the Old Testament. How many of God's prophets, how were they treated? Right? In the Beatitudes, blessed are you when you are reviled, hated, when your name is drug out as something bad and evil, just like the prophets of old, Jesus says. Blessed are you when you are treated like the prophets of old. So, a prophet is not accepted in his own country. Pretty simple on the surface, right? What is Jesus just claiming by that little proverb? For Jesus to quote this in the context of their rejection of him, he says, no prophet is accepted in his own country. What has he just said to them?
He's a prophet.
I'm the prophet. That's right. So he uses a proverb to communicate something that's very powerful, and he communicates in a very brief, simple, memorable way. Okay? He's a prophet. So they say, Joseph's son. But when they say, Joseph's son, when they reject Joseph's son, what are they really doing? They're rejecting God's prophet. They are rejecting the prophet of prophets when they say, oh, he's just... They're not just rejecting Joseph's son, are they? They are rejecting the prophet of prophets, the one foretold. No prophet is accepted in his own country. So when a prophet is rejected in his own country, what does he do? There's something else going on here. Simple little proverb, but Jesus has just opened up. We might call it a can of worms, but in the context, what does Jesus then go on to say? He says something about Elijah. What did Elijah do? Elijah suffered rejection. What did he do? Who listened to him? What's that? His enemy, right? Went to some Gentile, right? And what about Elisha? Elisha was rejected. What did Elisha do? Well, he went away. Right? So we have these outsiders who are listening. The prophets, they go, they leave, and they preach to people who listen to them. What is Jesus saying? This is marvelous. We duly note that this is in Luke. Luke, the Gentile, is making sure that he records this. This would be very important to you as a Gentile, you suppose? It's a hint early on in the gospel. And there's other hints early on in the gospel, too. Jesus is laying down a hint through a very simple point. It seems simple on the surface, prophet is not accepted in his own country, perhaps the Gentiles will listen to me. So it is a description of himself and his ministry, of who he is, and it's a diagnosis of their condition. And he's laying out to them basically this, that you're acting like your rebellious fathers before you who rejected the prophets. You're acting just like them. Just like them. Simple proverb. Jesus is employing it. Simple on the surface, but it works on some very profound levels. All right, now sometimes you may come across a parable that is immediately hard to understand. Let me give you an example from Luke chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 36 says, "Then he spoke a parable to them. No one puts a piece from a new garment on an old one. Otherwise, the new makes a tear. And also the piece that was taken out of the new does not match the old." That's a parable about clothing, or drawn from clothing. Okay, you don't put a piece from a new garment on an old one. Otherwise, the new makes a tear, and the piece that was taken out of does not match the old. Everything's ruined. If you try to patch up the old with the new, both are ruined. Now he gives a second proverb. It makes the same point. "And no one puts new wine into old wineskins, or else the new wine will burst the wineskins and be spilled, and the wineskins will be ruined. But new wine must be put into new wineskins, and both are preserved." If you try to put new wine into an old form, it doesn't work. It'll burst the old wineskin, and then what do you have? You've got two ruined things. You ruined the old wineskin, and now you've ruined the new wine because it's spilled out on the ground. Now, and we won't go fully into it at this point, but the context tells us that Jesus is speaking of the Old and New Covenants. He's laying out groundwork for understanding this time of transition that they're in. And the Pharisees are complaining about, well, why doesn't, you know, John's disciples, they fast, but Jesus, your disciples don't fast. And Jesus is laying out, there's this time of transition that's happening. We are moving into a new era, is what Jesus is explaining. And so, simple proverbs about a patch of clothing or the wineskin, and he's laying out some very profound truths about how Jesus didn't come to patch up the old covenant. He didn't come to get it all sewed back together and patched up. To do that would have ruined the purpose of the old covenant, and to do that would have ruined the purpose and the meaning of the new covenant. New covenant is not going to be poured into old covenant wineskins. The old covenant is going away. There's a new covenant. There's a better covenant. We try to pour new covenant blessings back into old covenant forms. What's going to happen? The old covenant can't contain it. It was never designed to contain it. It was designed for a certain purpose, and that purpose is finished. The new covenant wine must be poured into new covenant wineskins. Marvelous things to think about. And we get those from these simple little proverbs. That one at first may seem a little bit more complex, but we have a context to help us. So here's what we're doing. When we work on proverbs, it takes work, doesn't it? And that's a part of the design. The wise men don't spoon feed us. They make us work for it. If the wise men were to just spoon-feed us, then we would never learn to develop the muscle of wisdom. So we're gaining wisdom by learning how to do it. We're gaining wisdom by learning how to work with these riddles, these strange sayings, these sayings that contain mystery to them. And if you want to have the fruit of wisdom, then you have to work on it. You've got to think about it. You've got to contemplate and think about, well, what a new patch on an old piece of clothing, okay, and you have to start to work through that. And new wine in an old wineskin, and you begin to work through that to get to the point where your own understanding has improved and wisdom and knowledge have been strengthened. So wisdom is a muscle. It's given to you as a gift by the Spirit, but it's a muscle that has to be stretched. It's a muscle that has to be exercised if it's going to grow into maturity. The wise do not spoon-feed us. They make us work through thinking. They make us do the work of analyzing, looking at things and discovering relationships, and looking at things and doing the hard work of discovering these relationships of especially action and consequence. This is a means to attain to wisdom. Okay, so one goal that the wise have for us is to expose our ignorance. They want to expose our ignorance and our limited perspective. Here's what we like to do. We like to look at a situation, or you look at a situation and you think about it. And then you decide that you understand it, right? Don't you do this every day? You look at something, and then you take whatever time you think, and then you come away thinking, okay, I've got it. I've got a handle on this. Maybe it's a situation that's got some movement or a plot, and you're thinking, oh, okay, from these things, I can anticipate what's going to happen. Yeah, I've got a handle on it. I can see the picture. I can see what's going on with this. You begin to predict things. But the truth is that we can miss things because our perspective is too limited. We can miss things because we have blind spots. But the thing about a blind spot is you don't know you have it. That's what's tricky about a blind spot. You think you've looked, and you think there's no car in the other lane. And then you begin to move, and boom. Why? You had a blind spot. You were blind to it. You thought, well, one of the goals of the wise men with their riddles and their proverbs is to show us that we have blind spots, and we have to learn to do this work of discovering those. Proverbs and parables can be designed to focus on a specific muscle group or a specific weakness in our understanding or perspective. But we can be resistant, can't we, to being worked on? Because you don't want to admit that you have a blind spot. You'd rather think that, no, I've got this. And the wise man comes along and says, no, you don't got this. And you want to be resistant. And you say, no, I've... So there are some techniques that the wise use to draw you in to their lesson, to get you to the point of exercising a particular muscle, to a lesser or greater degree. We always have this wall of pride around us, don't we? We have this wall of pride. And it's because we foolishly think that that wall of pride is protecting us from harm, when the harm is inside the wall, right? So the wise men have these techniques to break through that wall of pride, and so they can get to working on what the real danger is, which is some blind spot that we might have. And so breaking through a wall requires tools. I'm slowly getting back to Luke 16. Breaking through that wall requires tools, and the wise men, oh, they've got the tools. They know how to use them. All right, so one tool in the wise man's toolbox, and it's a tool, of course, in the toolbox of our Lord, is the tool called surprise. Or it's the tool called the plot twist. It's the surprise at the end. A proverb or a parable can begin to take you in a certain direction. It can seem to be headed in a predictable destination or to a predictable conclusion, and it then takes you to a place that you were not expecting. It broke through that wall, and by the time it breaks through the wall, it's too late. It's in. You have to deal with it. You have to admit, right? Let me give an example from the book of Ecclesiastes, one that I've preached to you. Beginning of Ecclesiastes 7, a good name is better than precious ointment, ... That's the first part. A good name is better than precious ointment. Do you agree with that? Reputation has more value than expensive perfume. Right? Yeah, of course. You agree with that. Is that saying that perfume is absolutely worthless? Absolutely no value at all to perfume. It's not saying that. It's giving a relative perspective. They both have value. They both have good use. But there is a value that a good reputation has that far exceeds the value of expensive perfume. Do you agree? Do you understand that? Do you see what's you maybe didn't realize what just happened, but the wise man has broken through the wall. Because that's just the first half of the proverb. So you agree with the first half, but see, now you're stuck. The wise man has you right in the palm of his hand. So as true as the first part of the proverb is, so true will be the second half of the proverb, which is what? The day of death is better or is of more value than the day of one's birth. See, he got you. If he started off by saying a memorial service has, in some ways, more value than a birthday party. Well, immediately, with the wall's there, you're thinking, this is ridiculous. But he breaks through the wall with a statement that's clear. It's about comparing two things. Okay, I can do that. Can you compare two things, the wise man says? Yes, I can compare two things. Okay, well, let me lay these two things in front of you. A good name and expensive perfume. Can you compare those two things? Oh, yeah. Which is more valuable? Well, they both have value, but the reputation has a value that this one doesn't have. He goes, that's good, that's fine. Let me lay two more things in front of you. All right, the day of your death or the day of your birth. And you're like, oh, blind spot. A technique. You didn't expect the proverb to go in that direction, did you? Comparing things. I can do that. Yeah, I can look at two things, and how good are you at evaluating things? Oh, I got that. The wise man says, you got that? Okay, well, let's begin to explore and see if you have any blind spots. It went in a direction you didn't expect. And that surprise element, that plot twist, is very effective. It draws you in, and then it gets you, and you're now at a point where it's too late. You have to admit, okay, yeah. I hadn't really thought about that way before. I had a blind spot. My perspective was limited, and now it's been exposed. Okay? Sorrow is better than laughter, that little proverb goes on to say. By a sad countenance, the heart is made better. Interesting things. All right? So before the proverb took you to the gymnasium of wisdom, you might have been pretty confident in the strength of your wisdom, but the proverb puts you to the exercise, and by the end of the proverb, you're feeling humbly sore. Ooh, I haven't worked out that muscle as much as maybe I should have. I'm feeling a little sore. Right? The day of my death is better, or has some value that's better than the day of my birth. Ooh, you know, you kind of feel that. But the muscle's been worked. Maybe a muscle that you haven't been working as much as you should have been working. All right? Okay, now let me give you another fun one. Fun. Now you probably know how this one ends, but if you already know how it ends, just play along, okay? Here's the first part of the proverb. As a ring of gold in a swine's snout, ... As a ring of gold in a swine's snout. Here's what the wise man does. He says, hey, let's go take a trip. We're going to go out to the pig farm. You go, okay, we'll go to the pig farm. You go out to the pig farm, and the wise man goes over to the pen where all these pigs are. He goes, hey, come here. Take a look at that. Take a look at that pig over there. You look, and that's a pig. He says, well, tell me what you see. So you take another look, and there's a ring in the pig's snout. Now, you grew up in the country. You understand what a ring does in a pig's snout. It's not for decoration. It's not for leading. You don't put a chain on it and lead the pig around, right? A pig uses its snout to dig. Now, we here in Texas fully understand the feral hog problem, and of how a group of these things can go through a farmer's field, and when they're done, it looks like somebody plowed the field up. And it's from their snouts. They're digging for roots and grubs and worms and other kinds of hog delicacies. So the farmer, he's got an issue on his hand. He's got a pig who keeps destroying the ground where he's keeping the pigs. The thing keeps digging out under the fence and getting out, so he puts a ring, or maybe more than one ring, in the snout, and that makes it too uncomfortable for the pig to dig with the snout, and it breaks the pig of that habit. So you understand all of that. There's a pig over there, he's got a ring in his nose. Oh, okay, fine, that's no big deal. And the wise man goes, no, take another look. Take another look at that ring. And you look, and it's in a very muddy environment, but it's shiny enough. You can see that it's shiny. You go, oh, okay, well, that is kind of odd that he didn't use a steel ring. But, okay, so he used a brass ring. And the wise man goes, no. He says, that's gold. That big ring in the nose of that pig over there, wallowing in mud, that snout is in all that nasty pig food, that's a ring of gold. And you go, oh. And the wise man then says, what does that remind you of? What does that remind you of? Well, now you're working on it, aren't you? You're running this over in your mind. That's the point of the proverb. The wise don't spoon feed us. A gold ring in the snout of a pig. What in the world can this be an illustration of? You have to work on it. You have to exercise this muscle of looking at the juxtaposition, this strange thing of a gold ring in the snout of a pig. Well, first of all, we'd say it's surprising because those things don't fit together. They don't fit. They don't belong together. There's something ill-fitting about it. There's a conflict in the picture, isn't there? It's a mismatch. And we begin to think about it some more, and we might say, or I would certainly say, well, that looks like a waste of gold. That gold could be put to better use, couldn't it? A ring, or you know, something like that. A coin. It's a waste of gold. And you can say, and then you can begin to think to yourself, well, whatever value the gold has, it really doesn't change the value of the pig. You begin to work these things over in your mind. All right? How does that proverb finish? Anybody know? As a ring of gold and a swine snout, so is a lovely woman who lacks discretion. Is that the direction that you thought the proverb was going to go? This is a lovely woman who lacks discretion. She's a foolish woman. She lacks discretion. The outward beauty of a woman, or the outward beauty of the gold, doesn't change or outweigh the fact that the animal is a dirty pig. Are you going to hang in there with me? This is tough. This is tough. It's exercising a muscle. Yes, the ring is pretty, but we're still looking at a pig. Pretty appearance doesn't make up for the unholiness of character. You're an Old Covenant listener, aren't you, to this proverb originally. The pig was an unclean animal. Wow. Ring of gold and a swine snout. Maybe you weren't expecting it to go in the direction of describing a certain kind of woman. When I look at that proverb, I think, wow, what a waste of gold. If I look at a pretty woman who is a fool, I ought to be saying, what a waste of pretty. What a waste of pretty. Is God saying that a beautiful outward appearance has absolutely no value at all? No, he's not saying that. A woman who is beautiful, she ought to thank that as a good gift that God has given her. But all of that, with unholiness of character and a foolish, unbelieving heart, it's a waste of pretty. And all that pretty doesn't change her heart, does it? That ring, that pretty ring of gold is still in the snout of a pig. So it's surprising, isn't it? It's a surprising direction for the proverb to go, but it's also very effective, isn't it? It's a very powerful way to deliver a rebuke. I mean, of all of the ways to portray wasting something, couldn't the proverb have been a little nicer about it? A pig, really? An unclean animal under the old covenant regulations. Wow. But now it's stuck in your head, isn't it? In a very powerful way. A very memorable way. Of all the ways to portray the importance of the heart as having this value over the value of the outward appearance, this is a very memorable way of doing it. The pig, as an unclean animal, the pig is occupying a very low place. When you think of the pig farm and you think of the pretty woman, there's this conceptual distance, right? These are not the same things in your mind, right? I've got this. The wise man lays the pretty woman and the pig farm side by side. Can you evaluate these? And you say, oh yeah, I got that. Those things aren't even anything alike. Very different, you want to say. And the wise man goes, really? Well, let's think about this. And by the use of this proverb, which draws you in with a mysterious statement and then gets you with the application, the proverb doesn't just reduce that conceptual distance. The proverb says they're the same. They're the same. In some situations, we're looking at the same thing. So for the ladies in the room, let me ask you, what kind of an effect does this proverb have on you? Anybody willing to speak up at this point? What kind of an effect, what effect does this proverb have on you, ladies, if you're willing to admit? No. Yes.
I mean, it's humbling. It causes you to think about what the focus is on, like what you place importance on in terms of where you're trying the hardest to grow or excel, whether it's on a physical appearance or on the fear of the Lord.
Really, it's really hard hitting, isn't it, to make you think? And it's not saying that you should try to make yourself as ugly as possible, as if beauty is in and of itself inherently sinful. All right? A beauty that a woman has is a gift that God gives to her. But it is a powerful way to show a woman, okay, these two things each have their own value, holiness of character and outward beauty, but there's a beauty of character that far outweighs an outward appearance. And there's other proverbs we could go to that speak about how brief the vanity of outward beauty, how brief it is. Right? So the proverb is pouring coals on your heads, isn't it, ladies? But, you know, it's humbling you in a good way. Men in the room, what kind of an effect should this proverb have on you? Anybody willing to admit? Yes, sir. What kind of an effect should this have on you, men?
It makes me think that no matter how pretty a woman is, if she's going around and she's sleeping around with everybody, you know, being unruly and such, no matter how pretty she is, she's still dirty. She still has no self-control, and she's still so dirty that she ought to be going around in the mud.
And so how should you respond? Yeah, that's exactly right. The steps of an immoral woman will take you straight to hell. And it is the exception if a man ever finds ever does a U-turn on that path. That's Proverbs 3. Right. Don't get fooled, men. You got to keep things in perspective. A young man says, well, I don't have any blind spots. The wise man says, oh, yes, really? Let's explore that a little bit. Well, I'm not blind. I'm wise. I'm smart. Really? I'm not going to get carried away with emotions or, okay, let's explore that a little bit. Let's explore what the reality of this situation is. All right, so young men, those of you who are interested in a wife, you ought to take this proverb to heart. Okay? God isn't commanding you to avoid pretty women. Right? He is saying you got to think about the whole picture. All right. So Luke 16, I think, is an example of some of these things that we have been looking at. Jesus draws you in at the beginning of the parable, doesn't he? Look at this scoundrel. Look at this lying, cheating, stealing, incompetent unbeliever. And we say, yes, look at him. Look at that rotten scoundrel, lying, cheating, stealing. You know where you're at? You're right in the palm of the Lord. He draws you in. You are right where he wants you. And then at the end, he flips it. That scoundrel is doing something better than some believers. The story goes in a direction all of a sudden that you weren't expecting. And it's like coals, hot coals on our head. We weren't thinking, we weren't expecting that this scoundrel was going to be used as an illustration of how some believers in some ways are doing some things better than believers ought to be doing. And it's a very powerful technique of the wise to get past the wall of pride, and once in, now the real problem can be attacked. Right? That parable at the beginning of Luke 16, it's genius. It's brilliant. It's perfect. He draws us in, and with this technique or tool called the surprise or the plot twist, he has us right where he wants us. And by that point, it's too late. Because by the time we get to the twist, we've already made all of these conclusions about this scoundrel, haven't we? Right? He is behaving, obviously, as an unbeliever. It's very clear. And that's how then Jesus can go on to make the point that there are sons of this world who in some ways are showing better wisdom than those who are the sons of light. And we say, ouch. But it's a very powerful way. Somebody asked me this question after the sermon, and I'll leave you with a question and then the answer that I gave. Somebody, and this is such a great question, I wanted to pass it along to you to think about. The question after the sermon was, I wonder why Jesus chose a parable involving a sinful practice to command prudence. He could have told a story about some honest fellow practicing it. Well, he could have, right? But I think it would have been less powerful. It would have had less of an impact. Why did he pick a scoundrel to present a lesson to believers? The twist at the end really brings home the impact of it. Here's the answer that I gave. Why did Jesus pick a scoundrel to do this? It serves to highlight the rebuke. If an unbeliever can have the wisdom of foresight for dishonest and temporary reasons, how much more ought believers live with foresight for honest and eternal reasons? And that's the point of the parable. Okay, so sometimes Jesus will he'll present a simple proverb, but if it works on you and you do the work of contemplation, it begins to unfold some more profound meanings. And sometimes Jesus will tell a parable where there's a twist at the end. That's an old technique that the wise use to break past the walls of pride, to get in, to deal with that blind spot that you might be resistant to admit that you have at the very beginning. All right. Well, I hope that's helpful to you. That's a little bit of background on some techniques that Jesus is using, and we see some of those there in the parable of the steward with wise foresight.